what's your surname, or how do I pronounce your surname? Alice Side? Your last name, Jean?
Denis Merle.
Denis
Merle. My name, my family name.
Yeah.
Merle, M-U-L-L.
M-U-L, Merle. Merle.
Like the island, drinking whiskey.
Oh, in Scotland?
Scotland, yeah.
Wow, the island of Merle. Yeah. Jean Merle.
Yeah.
I mangled it with my, you know, my scouts.
No, Jean Denis.
Jean
that's
Denis.
My real name.
Jean Denis.
But that's only the French who called me Jean Denis.
Jean
you
Denis.
You have no two names as a name in English language. Most of the time, I mean, you called yourself John or Patrick or Paul or Theodore or whatever, but not Jean-Denis, Jean-Charles, Jean-Étienne, you know. So people, I mean, since I left France, people, they just call me Jean.
Yeah. Jean the Baker.
Jean the French.
Jean-Denis.
Jean-Denis.
Okay.
Jean-Denis. No, but call me French. Call me Jean.
Jean.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Jean, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Jean is the most amazing baker that I've had the pleasure to meet and eat his bread. I'm lucky guy. We're going to eat some of his bread today. Jean is the baker at Lagos Market where we met and we frequent and we have the, you know, the distinction of being able to jump the queue occasionally, because Jean has a queue that goes around the block for his bread, which is just outstanding. There are two stalls in Lagos Market that have a large queue. One is the blueberry guy and the raspberries, and the other is you. And it's always quite an impressive sight to see people queuing up for your bread. So welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I mean, it's very gratifying when you see so much people coming to buy your bread.
Yeah.
And some people say, are you selling your bread? I don't sell anything. I just make bread. And that's probably among all the jobs that I did in my life, it's the most gratifying, because people, they buy what you did. Mm-hmm. So you have a responsibility, you know, it's a small responsibility. It's not driving a helicopter, bringing people from one place to, I'm just a simple baker, but people like the bread. You know, I try to use the best ingredient that I can. And I mean, actually, I mean, making bread is very easy. Anyone could make bread. It's the consistency and the products that you pick in order to make your bread makes a difference. I think that the intention is very important too. And the translation of that is, yes, indeed. I mean, I'm very happy I see these queues. I mean, I got to go faster in order to serve everyone. And usually, I mean, an hour and a half after the beginning of the market, I sold out, I mean, 90% of what I produced the 2 days before the market. So that's cool, yeah.
How many loaves? Because last time I asked you, you said it was nearly 200 loaves.
Yeah, for Wednesday, 200 loaves, yeah.
That's amazing, yeah.
But 200 loaves, I mean, if you consider there is brioche, there is the gluten-free, there is the rye, there is the spelt, you know, there is the campagne, there is the rustic, there is whatever, there is the walnuts and raisin, there is the olives and pimiente. Yeah, there is like maybe 10 different varieties of bread. It's a lot when you got to prepare, because I go everything I do manually. You know, I don't have a pétrin, the traditional pétrin. I thought about having a pétrin. Do you know what is a pétrin?
No.
This machine is going to mix that, blend your dough, you know what I mean? Like anyone would have something like that in this type of quantity. I don't know, but I refuse to get a pétrin for two reasons, because I got so much to do in terms of diversity that I got a pétrin. And then, I mean, I got to get 10 different pétrins. So if I do when I do 10 different bread, I almost do 5 type of bread in the same time. So I got to work with my hand to do that. With a pétrin, it wouldn't be possible in this type of quantity. So I'm trying to develop my little business, but around working with my hand. And at the end of the day, that makes the difference when you work with your hand, when you use your body to do something.
Mm. Well, I think it's demonstrated by the success of, you know, your business at the moment, because you've been doing this for about 4 or 5 years, is that correct?
Yeah, four years, yeah, I believe, yeah, four years, yeah.
And you wouldn't think that such a simple product, such as bread, is so hard to do. And it seems as if it's like we've kind of departed from the simple things, and bread being one of them. And that's maybe one of the secrets of your success, is that you're doing something simple really, really, really well. And what do you think, you know, why isn't there more people making simple bread really, really well?
Well, there is no more, or why there will be more? I mean,
well, it's demonstrated by the queues that you have, right? Is that people obviously can't get it elsewhere, so they're coming to you to get what they want, which is high quality, you know, authentic bread.
I think that I'm not the only one around to make good bread, but I'm lucky enough to get the markets and the market, but there is a substantial volume that makes my family living quite decently. But in this proportion of business, I'm just right in the middle between being a professional baker and an amateur baker. Mm-hmm. So if you're an amateur baker, your kitchen is enough. But then you're going to produce like maybe 10, 20 bread for your families and friends around your area. If you're a professional one, then it's going to cost you lots of money to run the business.
Yeah.
I'm just right in the middle. It doesn't cost too much me, except the bills of electricities and the flowers and the work I put in. But it's a lot of work. And people, they don't realize, I mean, 3 days, it's 3 days working hard physically, you know, a few hours. I mean, of course, there is some moments I've got the time to watch podcasts, I mean, to listen, to read. But still, you have to be here and you have to get a tick in your mind in order to know when it's time to stop, when it's now start to put it in the oven. I mean, it's a whole organization which asks lots of intuition, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, patisserie or even kitchen, a professional setting kitchen, where you get to be very, very organized. No, I got my organization, but by the time, I mean, I don't even think about it, you know, and 200 bread, I mean, it's...
Do you have like a mise-en-scene, is it, you know, with your preparation of the bread?
No. Well, like, you mean like this guy, like the Japanese that we watched, I mean, who do his little prayer before?
Yeah.
No, but I noticed one thing is, if the day before, because sometimes you don't want to make bread. Sometimes you're tired. You want to do something else. And you're like, okay, tomorrow I'm going to make the best bread that I can do. I know that if the day before I repeat myself just a couple of times, not like a mantra, but just a couple of times, that tomorrow I want to make an excellent job for my client. I mean, usually I got an excellent day running smoothly the 2 days before the market. And okay, the 2 hours that I spent in the market, they are great because I got to go fast, but I see the same face, new people. I heard about your bread. I'm coming from this guy, blah, blah, blah. So it's just pleasant, you know.
I mean, I really love Lagos Market. It's one of the best things about the area for me, because it's, you know, you get to see all of these great artisans.
Yeah.
Who bring all of their produce from the hills and the mountains, and they come down and, you know, with amazing fruits and vegetables and pastries and empanadas and your bread. And you have that little community there where people, the kids come and, you know, there's music. And
lots of kimchi, I mean, fermented vegetables. I mean, you get a bunch of more and more people who are fermenting things. And it's very complicated to find the right balance between the spice and the taste of the vegetables that they use and the acidity and you know, I mean, some people, they do just an excellent job. I mean, and I can see that it's growing. I mean, year after years, because I mean, people I feel that they don't have the same impact in terms of inflation that if they were shopping in a supermarket, because the price are pretty steady. I mean, I didn't increase my price since 3 years.
Wow.
And I think I'm not the only one, because of course 95% of what we shop ourselves as consumer, my wife, I mean, we go to the market, we buy the vegetables and the kimchi and everything at the market, and actually we pretty all right in terms of price. I got the feeling that it's more or less the same price than 3 years ago. And then there are more and more people bringing like beautiful products, and it's a social place, you know.
Yeah.
It's a little bit different than the Saturday morning where it's more running.
I've never been on the Saturday morning because that's both sides, isn't it? Both sides of the market.
Yeah.
On a Saturday, yeah, is it the same kind of people in the in the vegetable side?
I would say more Portuguese.
Ah, okay.
It's more open because you don't have only organic products.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, what we got the Wednesday afternoon, it's mainly organic. Mm. If it is not certified, I mean, people, they buy organic. My flowers is organic. But by the way, I mean, organic, it's not the answer to everything. There are farmers, they are not certified organic, but you can make sure that what they produce is organic.
Because I spoke to a few farmers in England about this, and it was like, look, we run an organic farm, but to get the certification is such a bureaucratic nightmare in order to get the certification that it costs them so much money to do that they just don't bother, but they still do everything organically, you know?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think it's more a matter of philosophy to be organic, and it's... You cannot really feel good if you are talking to people saying that what you sell or what you produce is organic, where it's not organic. I don't remember if I told you that for a while, a few years ago, before we moved to Portugal, we were between Switzerland and Costa Rica. And we went to Asia and we started to import tea. My wife was at that time a Qigong instructor.
Mm-hmm.
We got into these people and she had the chance to visit a bunch of places where you buy tea. Real producers, you know, ancient tea trees. And those guys explained to us how it works in terms of certification, organic certification. There is not only the organic certification, there is also what they call the fair play, you know, the
fair trade.
The fair trade. You know, so this, you know, I mean, it's a lot of time rubbish, you know. Mm. I mean, you know, they would bring like interpret to talk with people from China, from the forest, from the wood. They're attached to a garden where you have like 100 years old trees picking the leaves. And they would get into a conversation with the translators right in the middle. Nobody speaks except few guys the language that it's not even Mandarin. It's the language of the people living in the forest.
Wow.
And those guys, they are actually employees of the guy who runs the company. But, I mean, since nobody really understands each other, I mean, they pretend that they work for themselves. Well, they don't really work for themselves. So you can sit on the fair trade, you know. It's not really fair trade. Like, it's not always, like, organic if it is certified organic, you know. So there is lots of, like, things around the organic stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
It's quite political as well, as I think, isn't it? You know. And it gives them an opportunity to charge a premium
for
a product that normally, you know, they make a 20-30% less for.
I'm
always a little bit wary of the whole organic thing because I think it could be a little bit of a scam. But you know,
the European community today, I mean, you don't have to write the origin of the products that you buy.
Mm.
So you have one guy who's been working for a few generations raising chicken, the best chicken in the world, fed the right way, living in the fantastic area, and then they compete with a chicken who comes from a factory in Ukraine.
Mm.
So, I mean, you know, the purchasing power of the normal people in France and in Europe generally goes down so fast that it's, you know, like, okay, I'm going to feed myself, you know. I'm going to take the Ukrainian chicken. He doesn't know that he takes the Ukrainian chicken. He doesn't know that he supports actually what's going on in the world by buying the cheapest one, you know. But he goes to the shop to buy an Apple phone.
Mm.
But he buy an Ukrainian chicken. He doesn't identify. It doesn't make the difference between the and it gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something like that wouldn't have happened like 20 years ago because our parents, our grandparents, they knew what was more important. What's the most important things after all? It's to eat properly. It's not only about feeding ourselves. I mean, feeding ourselves in order to feel good. It's also having a link between us and the land. If you cut this link,
well, that's what they want.
There's
isn't
nothing.
It?
There is nothing left.
There's a Kissinger. There's a famous quote from Kissinger, which is like, "Control the food, and you control the people."
Yeah,
you know, and that's what we've seen over the last 40, 50 years is this industrialization of food production.
Yeah,
and you know, the food that we're served up now is just. It's just empty, isn't it? It's like slop, right? But it's well presented and it looks good and it's got a nice smell, but reality is it's just garbage, you know?
Yeah, and it takes like maybe 10 years or 15 years to put in the mind of people, for example, that eating a banana is equivalent to eat a piece of beef.
Yeah.
Remember, I mean, I read this book years ago about Banana Republic.
They explain
how they built Guatemala and Honduras and the Latin American country.
Yeah.
Who were like, there was no banana at the beginning. Banana is a fruit from the Asia.
Because there was wars over that, wasn't there? There was wars fought in South America for the big banana companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now they do that with avocado.
Right. It's big here, isn't it?
In Algarve.
Yeah.
In Algarve, you have like two, three around Lagos. You might have between 300 and 400 hectares of avocado. And then to get an avocado growing fast and bringing fruit, you have to go deep into the land to get the water.
Ah, right, yeah.
So I don't remember. I mean, I talked with serious people who told me how much water they got out of the land in order to get this tree going out very quickly. But you have no idea how much it is. It's a lot.
Mm.
And in the meantime, you got the little farmer, the little one, like the little baker. But I'm not touched by that yet. But some farmers that you see at the market, they're like, well, we don't have any more water.
Because the avocado farms are taking it all.
Yeah.
Right.
Can I dig a little bit deeper? No, you don't have the right. Okay, maybe I'm going to try to do it like this. Well, if you do that that way, I mean, you got like a fine, 50,000 divided by between the guy who go deeper and you who order the guy to go deeper in terms of water. So, and they say... It's like a little bit like I compare that to the hoax of climate change. They say, well, there is no more water, but you don't have the right to check it out.
Mm.
But if there is no more water, let me check it out.
Unless you're an avocado farmer and you want to produce, hundreds of thousands of avocados.
Absolutely, yeah. And you get the money from you get the subsidy from the European Community. Yeah.
And who are the biggest purchasers of avocados as vegans? It's the World Economic Forum diet, isn't it? The
Absolutely.
Avocado. Yeah, yeah.
So you eat avocado, you eat banana, you eat mosquitoes and insects and all sort of things, but you don't eat more meat.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like crazy.
How did you get into being a baker? Because I know you've done a lot of other things as well, but like me, right? But this is your latest incarnation. This is your latest, aspect of your personality. It's become Jean the Baker. How did you stumble into becoming a legendary baker in Algarve?
No, I found that it was very difficult to find good bread.
Mm.
And back then, 5 years ago, well, I mean, 10 years ago when I came first in Algarve, there was one German baker. He had a bakery, a real bakery in Lagos. And unfortunately for the guy, I mean, he passed away. And then when I came back 6-7 years ago, we used to buy our bread to this Brazilian lady Saturday morning at the market, you know. I even talk about her. I mean, we got to share. I mean, the bread was very good and still good. It's not the same bread that I do, but she's very good at what she does. And that is where I used to buy the bread. And then I was not totally satisfied because I wanted to do something more related to fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
But I stumbled in the fermentation world like by mistake. I mean, I found a book in my home and I was like going chapter after chapter discovering. I mean, what is, oh, well, that's a kimchi. And this, oh, well, that's a choucroute. That's the way they do choucroute. Oh, that's so cool. And then there was a chapter of the bread. Oh, pain au levain. Oh, man, I mean, I'm French. I didn't know it was a pain au levain. So I'm going to do my levain. And that's how I started to make bread. And I was lucky enough to meet some people who say, can I participate in market Wednesday afternoon? It was like, well, that's good because now they're going to set up not only for the summer season, but for the whole year, the market. And I started with 50 bread. Maybe not. I mean, 40 bread the Wednesday, and some of them they were burned, and some of them they were looking weird, you know. But I mean, and I was pushing, and I was cutting the bread, giving people the banana step by step. I improved my products. Yeah?
But it was like, because I had a whole period where I found the same fermentation books. I've got one upstairs. We were chatting about it earlier, and I got into the fermentation a little bit too, because it's kind of related to the idea that we don't really ferment inside our bodies, unlike, you know, like gorillas or, you know, cows or horses. They ferment inside. We ferment our food outside the body, and then we eat it because we don't really have the gut to ferment inside. And with things like probiotics and good bacteria, what we hear about, and if you've got like gut issues, you might want to try fermentation to heal them. And like I was doing, kefir.
Yeah.
Which is amazing.
Yeah.
I really, really like kefir. I had the little kefir grains that would grow, and you could keep them going forever. Yeah. You know, they don't really know where kefir came from. Yeah. They've got it's just been passed down by generation to generation. Yeah. And then I was doing like sauerkraut and kimchi, and I never did bread, but I just thought it was a really interesting like area of food, because our ancestors didn't have refrigerators.
No.
And they didn't pasteurize things like we do now, which keeps them, you know, on the shelf longer and in the fridge. They used to ferment everything to give it, you know, the life that it could last.
Yeah.
And we kind of lost that. And I think that's why we're seeing a renaissance of people being into these fermented foods, because, you know, you have the sausage as well, don't you hear?
The sausage.
The sausage.
That's fermented too.
Yeah. Yeah. So have you found that? Because have you found that there is, did you get into the fermentation from those perspectives and those ideas?
No, I was not. It was not like, okay, I mean, we're all vegetarian or we go all for fermentation. No, it was just like by mistake, you know, and that very quickly I understood that it was like, and I think that in the meantime, it's just like a couple of years after we came back from Asia that where, you know, in China, they ferment everything.
Yeah.
And if you go to
soy sauce is fermented, isn't it?
Yeah. If you go to China, I mean, you don't barely see any obese people.
Mm.
They can drink a lot. I'm not saying they're perfect. I mean, they're all like in the Shaolin temple, but I mean, they cook food is the most important thing for the Chinese. So they ferment everything. They cook everything they eat. They barely go to buy, I mean, except their noodles, their stupid little noodles for $1.50 that you buy in the supermarket. But most of the time they cook everything, vegetables, meat, they eat anything, you know. So, and the fermentation come from, well, we used to ferment a lot of things, but not as much as they ferment things like the soy, for instance. I mean, you know, so yes, the probiotic and all that, it's very important. I mean, what we eat today is dead. It's dead food.
Dead food.
That's why we becoming big.
Yeah.
Because we just eat dead food.
Mm.
And the organism is probably trying to get something from the dead food that you ingest, but they don't get too much. Mm. So you get your metabolism working a lot. But in the meantime, like, you have to produce energy, but you don't have the energy. I mean, most of people are tired very quickly. And when you look at young people today, I mean, unless they are athletic and they've been educated into sports, I mean, young people got tired very quickly if you compare to my generation.
Mm.
When I was a teenager, there was maybe barely one guy in the whole school who was big.
Mm.
We were all skinny. Now, I mean, you look up on the streets. I remember a few years ago, I went back to Thailand. I haven't been in Thailand in 20 years. I was struck the first time I went there. I mean, beautiful kids everywhere, all skinny, just pure muscle. You know what I mean? Like 20 years after I went there, I saw all kids like drinking.
Everyone's
Coke,
fat.
Fat, yeah.
Yeah, the West have arrived,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Terrible junk food.
But that's the thing about bread, though, as well. It's that I love bread. I love bread and I love wheat. But, you know, I've had to stop eating bread or anywhere near as much as I used to because it made me go boof.
But
this stuff is different, you know.
That's what I'm trying to explain to you, to your wife, when she comes to the market to buy the bread. I said, you don't buy enough bread. So at the beginning
you
I was
pusher.
Like,
okay. You're a bread pusher.
They call me Dr. Bread. I said, you don't buy enough bread. For your husband, you got to get a little bit of rye to make sure that he's not gonna bloat. I mean, there is no gluten.
But this is sourdough, isn't it?
That everything is sourdough.
And there's no yeast in sourdough. Is that
there
right?
There is yeast.
There is yeast. You add yeast?
No.
Yeah.
No, that's the yeast that you produce yourself.
From the starter.
From the starter, but you produce the starter yourself.
Yeah. So you don't add yeast, naturally forming yeast.
It's a natural fermentation.
Yeah.
So it's a fermentation like an alcoholic fermentation, except that it's a lactic fermentation.
Mm.
So the yeast, they eat the sugar. And by eating the sugar, they create the right bacteria that are going to be necessary for your gut in order to, you know, for your organism to use what your organism needs in order to feel good.
Mm.
And if you eat the bread that we produce today, especially in Argo, I mean, you just have like a supermarket bread.
Yeah.
And even bakery, I mean, even in France, I mean, 90% of the bakery, they are like supermarket bakery.
Even when they say it's sourdough, it's not really sourdough, or it's half sourdough. They'll mix like the normal stuff in with the sourdough because there is a trend at home, right? At least in England, because sourdough was all in the news and it was online, and everyone was wanting sourdough bread and sourdough pizzas and everywhere.
Yeah.
Right? And the big bread.
Yeah.
Big bread was trying to get in on the sourdough craze, and you'd see like supermarket bread with sourdough on it. And it wasn't the real thing.
Well, you know, you can say whatever you want. I mean, if you're kind of convincing enough, I mean, people are going to believe you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's as ridiculous as that. I mean, it's like going back to the banana and the avocado. We have produced as much as a piece of beef protein that is necessary for you to function, you know? So they say, okay, we do sourdough. There is like in Harold, they produce like little, how do you call that? Your little sandwich, which are very good actually in London with the little salmon and the little with the.
Oh, the bagel. The bagels. Salmon and cream.
Bagels.
Oh.
I don't know.
I've never had a sourdough bagel, I don't think, but yeah, it might be nice.
Or not. I mean, I don't know if it is sourdough.
But when you eat this bread, it's that authentic. Right, if it's like a meal in itself, all it needs is some butter. You can put the sausage.
Yeah, you do that.
It tastes like a meal in itself. I think I could live on the bread and butter. I think I could just survive on the bread on this type of bread. You know, it's so nutritious. You can feel the nutrition.
Yeah,
and you can taste
but
it.
I used to say something. I used to say that the bread maker and the bread, they are the. If you were like making a movie, the number one would be the cheese. The actor, the main actor,
okay.
The leading actor would be the cheese, the meat, the saucisson.
Yeah.
I mean, the things who ask more work and knowledge to be elaborated to the point it's good to eat.
Mm.
The bread is the supporting actor.
Okay.
If you get a nice saucisson.
Who would be the villain?
There is no villain. Well, the villain is the one who is in the supermarket.
Okay.
But the supporting actor is the one who is going to, if you are the best actor in the world,
mm-hmm.
but you have to play with a terrible guy, I mean, there is big chance that your play is going to be bad, you know. If you put the best saucisson in the world, which is more complicated to elaborate than a piece of bread, but you eat it with a bad piece of bread, that's a shame for the guy who prepared and worked over a generation to produce a wonderful foie gras or wonderful charcuterie or wonderful anything, you know, or a piece of cheese, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So the bread comes second.
I mean, it's all fermented, isn't it? The French stuff. You know, you got the Sassoon, you got the bread, you got the cheese, you got wine.
Yeah.
You know, this is all fermented food.
Yeah.
You know,
we have beer.
Beer. I mean, it's liquid bread, basically. Beer, isn't it? It's liquid bread.
Yeah. We go back to.
The French don't really drink beer, though, do they?
No, well, they're not known to drink beer, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. But all the French are not knowledgeable in wine, too.
Mm,
they drink maybe wine every day, but it doesn't mean that they're knowledgeable.
Mm.
It's like when I worked in the U.S. as a sommelier. I mean, people like, he's French, but with a French accent. He must know about wine. And, of course, I didn't know more. I mean,
I hope he didn't shatter their illusions. You know, let them think there's that. You know?
So I was like even like developing my French accent to make sure that there is no mistake between you and I. If I tell you that to take this bottle, there is a good reason for it.
I mean, as a French sommelier in America, that must have been an easy sell for you to push the wine.
Yeah. That was cool. Yeah. It was really cool. Americans are wonderful buyers.
Mm.
They're wonderful marketers. They're wonderful sellers and they're wonderful buyers.
We've just kind of nicely transitioned into your other incarnation as a sommelier in the US. How did that come about? How did you end up in America? Because like me, we've spent quite a bit of time in America and visited lots of places. You lived there for quite a period. And you know, I used to love going to America. I really, really used to love it. I haven't been back there for a long time, and I don't really like the look of it now. But, you know, there's something a little bit shady about it, you know. I don't know if I'd get in or whether I'd get out. That's the problem, right? But I used to love going, and I've been all over America. And you kind of, you've got a little bit of an American twang to your fantastic English, you know.
Yeah, I had lots of fun. Yeah. I mean, like you. I mean, I went the first time to America before the 11th September, and it was really cool. Mm. I mean, you can feel the atmosphere was not heavy at all. I mean, even when you got stopped by the cops because you didn't drive properly or because you were, I don't know, for some reason, I mean, they were cool. I mean, we could have a chat. It was, and then I came back from Ireland, where I spent a couple of years, to Los Angeles, just like 6 or 7 months after the 11th September. It was a different story. I mean, yeah, I could feel the 2 years who followed this 11th September thing, psyops, we say.
Inside job.
And well, I mean, that was different. And then it smooths out step by step. And yes, I mean, people know, you're French. I mean, we came to help you during World War II, and you don't come up to help us in Iraq. I mean, you know, the level of education, right, of people. I mean, you know, comparing the war in Iraq with the war in with Hitler. I mean, yeah. I was like, you know, it's a very short way to explain things, you know what I mean? Mm. So we had like a couple of arguments here and there. Mm. But nevertheless, the more I went, I stayed there, the more my English improved, and the more I felt good, the more I realized that there are so much things to do and to enjoy. It's a gigantic playground.
It's vast, and there's so many different. It's like many different countries within one space, isn't it? America. Yeah. That's probably a better way to understand it, rather than it just being one country. It's lots of countries within a federal kind of organization.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the space, you got the space. I mean, that's fantastic. You have the space. I mean, you don't have, when you live up in the mountain, you have lots of space. You can just, you don't need to go too far to feel that you are in the wilderness and you have no human being around. I mean, when you go hiking in Wyoming, I mean, you can spend days without seeing anyone. If you go to the French or the Swiss Alps, I mean, it's difficult to not meet anybody, you know. And when you come back from the United States, I guess it was the same for you. You feel like a little bit under pressure because... Because there is not this feeling of pressure. At least, I mean, I didn't feel it because I was not American, you know. So there is certain things you don't want to see. You don't see, like, I'm a French man living in Portugal. I mean, there is certain things that I don't see because my Portuguese is not enough.
One thing I like about being here is that I don't understand the politics. Yeah. I can't be affected by the propaganda because I don't understand the language.
Yeah.
Whereas at home, I'm bombarded with that. But here, I'm kind of immune to it, which is a relief.
Yeah. That's a relief.
Yeah.
Definitely. Mm.
So how did you end up being a sommelier? Because that's another fermented product, isn't it, with the wine? And it's like almost the most French thing you could possibly do.
Well, I mean, when I started to sell wine in the United States, I mean, I was not in restaurants, in the setting of restaurants. I mean, I was not a proper, like, certified or sommelier, but I was drinking more and more. And I spent some time in California visiting different, you know, doing what we call La Route des Vins and going tasting wine. But I felt that I missed the alphabet, you know. Which is, you play the guitar, I mean, okay, that's cool, you play the guitar, but if you want to step up, you got to know certain things, like certain fundamental. And when I had to come back to France, I was like, what am I gonna do? I mean, I've been away for 10 years. I mean, okay, now I speak English. I got lots of stories to tell about the United States, but how I'm going to do my living. And I decided to go for formation, a training, like a year training
in sommelier.
To become sommelier.
Because isn't there like... there's like there's different levels of certification for
that's the English American.
But isn't there like a top one that only like three people have ever achieved?
Yeah.
And it's like one of the most difficult examinations anywhere about anything in the world.
True. No, I'm far to be this type of guys. I mean, those guys they spend like
their whole life.
Studying, and it's not about being a sommelier. It's more about, you know, it's a sort of. Anyone who is, I mean, you got sommelier, but you also have wine makers. You might have like a guy who is not either a sommelier, wine maker, is totally passionate about the subject and spends his 30 years studying about wine. It's about memory. Mm. It's about tasting. It's about a lot of subject. It's not about sommelier. I mean, that's another story. It's the cerise on top of the cake, you know? I mean, if you have the time to study for 30 years to have the certification, it's like... It is useful in a sense that you learn a lot, but it is totally useless.
Yeah.
In a way. You know, you got... I mean, wine brings up so much subject. Mm. You can even be passionate about wine without drinking. You have history. You have how we make wine, but how we make wine before, how we make wine today, how we make wine in Italy, in California, in Australia, in Chile, in France. But in France, okay, but in the north, in the south, in the west, in the east. I mean, it's so diverse, you know, that you could spend like two lives just studying anything you want. You know, you want to study history, but you don't carry on drinking wine. That's fine. Mm. I mean, we need people like that to make people dreaming, you know, emotions, telling stories about the way they were making wine. I mean, how it works. I mean, how they passed on from generation to generation, the knowledge. It's an endless subject. But if you drink, it's even like, it's a trick because if you drink, you become, actually, if you don't know how to hold yourself, you become an alcoholic because you always have a good reason to drink a good glass of wine.
Mm.
But a good glass of wine, a real good glass of wine, brings a second and a third one.
But it's like English drinking culture is kind of not kind of quite suited for drinking wine because it's kind of beer based, and you know there's a lot of beer drinking going on. So I don't think the English quite understands truly how to drink wine from a social perspective. You know, it's
the first importers of wine were the English.
Wow.
At the beginning, the first client of Bordeaux, going back to the pre-war, the pre-Napoleonic War, there was the English. And then it became the Americans. You know, I mean, the reason why Porto became like so famous, it was created by the English.
Yeah, port, wasn't port. It? It was created
by the English.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if Portuguese listen to what we're saying, they're not going to like it. I mean, they created it together. Mm. But it was a good opportunity for the English to send their wine, to sell their wine somewhere back far away in their colonies like Australia, some wine that could travel easily.
Mm.
And port was traveling easily. And in the meantime, they had so much trouble with the French into going into war. So they installed the blockers and the French didn't want to sell the wine to the English. So the English, they got to find a way to keep making business with wine and sell it to the different colonies. And port was an excellent opportunity.
Wow.
You know, so the English, they were always into wine. Mm. And the best seller in the world, they are part of in London.
But it's never really been... It's kind of my understanding of it is like it's generally a modern thing for wine to be such a accepted part of English culture, you know, from the 80s onwards. Before that might have just been for, you know, a certain class of people or a certain level of people, but now it's kind of it's almost, you know, not replacing beer in the same way coffee in England now is replaced tea, but as tea was the national drink, you know, it's I feel as if wine is kind of entering into the, you know, the English lexicon as the main drink, but you don't think we quite know how to drink it. Drink a little bit too much. Drink it by the bottle instead of the glass, you know.
Let's say that the English are pretty enthusiastic.
Good description. But it's kind of like a, you know, it's not a touchy subject, but it's like, you know, the French regard themselves as the, you know, the premier place to produce wine. It's, you know, it's a part of the French national identity, isn't
it? Well, the French, they always look at themselves as very special people.
Yeah. You don't say.
Yeah, I mean, they're very special. Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. I make fun about
it.
I don't care.
But how is it being a Frenchman in America? And, you know, would we laugh at American wine? Is that something for us to, you know, to sneer at? Is it...
You know, in America, they produce wine everywhere.
Yeah.
Except in Alaska.
Okay.
Even in Florida.
Wow.
Even in Texas. Even in Mississippi. They produce wine everywhere. It's everywhere disgusting, except California with Napa Valley, Russian Napa Valley, River Valley.
Yeah.
Oregon, very good for Pinot Noir, and Washington State.
On the West Coast.
On the West Coast, yeah. Washington State, up north at the border. Mm-hmm. So that's the three places where you can find good wine. It started in California, but it started with Italian migrants and French migrants. That was not the English or the German.
So they were just bringing French and Italian technique to the valleys of Napa Valley and California.
And... Yeah, and they were pretty good because that's something that we can leave to the Americans when they put themselves into a subject. They perform pretty well.
Mm.
You know, they always perform pretty well when they decide to get into the competition.
Yeah,
they do everything in order to be among the best.
But they kind of lack the ancient tradition, like, of centuries old ways of doing things. Everything is nouveau, isn't it? You know,
That's probably the reason why when you speak with an American, he's always looking for some sort of Italian or French or Irish or German background. Yeah, my great great grandfather was from, you know.
Yeah.
They know that.
Yeah.
They lack these things that we have, but that's the way it is. Mm. You know, and that's interesting, because sometimes I got like into argument with them. I said, well, I mean, you're so new.
Mm.
You're so young and you're so arrogant.
Mm-hmm.
You forget that you're so new.
Well, if they want to muscle in on, you know, French monopoly on wine or Italian monopoly on wine, they're going to have to, you know, do something different, and because they don't have the culture, the tradition to be able to say, well, yeah, we've been doing this for a long, long time. We're the boss. So they've got to find another way in, and they usually use their muscle, don't they? You know?
Yeah.
You know? The financial muscle, the military muscle. And it's interesting that, you know, you were in America pre-2001 and post-2001, because it's almost like a defining moment in my life is, you know, what the world was like before 9/11 and what the world was like after 9/11.
Yeah.
It's a really pivotal moment in history, in the same way that COVID is a pivotal moment in history.
Yeah.
And I guess in some ways we are children of that, because, you know, you're in Algarve, I'm in Algarve, why are we here, right? Yeah. And I feel as if we're almost like Western European refugees, right?
Kind of, isn't that,
we're kind of trying to find a place where this overbearing authoritarian empire, run by the Americans, is trying to invade into the, you know, the most basic fundamental aspects of our lives, of our freedoms, of our children's lives and freedoms.
Yeah.
And what was the motivations for you coming here? Was it similar to me? And, you know, what's your take on the world right now? Because there's a lot going on.
When my son was on his way, he's 6 years old, we were like between Switzerland and France, and we have still family in France, but we knew that, you know, in France you have eight or nine injection,
mm-hmm.
mandatory. Eight, nine, now I think it goes up to 10 injection for little babies, injection.
It's incredible.
You know, but this is ridiculous. So, I mean, injection for hepatitis B. You know, I mean, you got to be fucking fucked up, I mean, to inject babies like that. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, nobody touched my son.
Mm.
My son is not the son of the Republic of France.
Yeah.
You know,
they like to think they are, though, don't they?
They want to do that.
Yeah.
They want to do that. And now they want to do that more than ever.
Mm.
They're trying to put in, it takes like 25 years to create a new generation of people, you know, they're starting. I mean, the last time I listened partly to the speech of Macron was like, we have to demographically rearm France. Means that there is not enough kids. We don't make enough kids, which is like a contradiction with what they did this last 30 years, but to fight against the Russian. So in other words, guys, make kids. The guy's a gay. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have any family. He doesn't know what it is to be a dad.
And his wife's a tranny.
Exactly. And he asked the French people to make kids to send to Russia. You know, after receiving like the bunch
of
injection.
How was that received though? With, you know, within the French population, are they as, you know, because we get this idea, this impression of the French being rebellious by their nature. And we've seen, you know, lots of protests on the streets over the last few years, the yellow vests, you know, and they seem to be, you know, serious about freedoms and stuff, but they never really seem to get anywhere, do they? It seems to be something that it's kind of part of an accepted part of French culture now, and but how do the French accept those ideas from Macron, you know, saying, you know, we need to produce more children?
Well, I mean, number one, the guy has been elected by 20% of the population.
Is that all?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's all. I mean, more or less 50% of the population doesn't go to vote. So as you know, I mean, the French vote system is going like that. First round, then you got two selected for the second round. So the guy, I mean, got in the second round maybe 51 or 52 against the Le Pen.
Yep.
But with 50% of people who vote, I mean, you make the calculation. I mean, actually, I mean, 70% of the population doesn't want, never wanted Macron. And plus the fact that there is more and more things linking about the fact that maybe, I mean, the election was kind of not exactly, you know, what happened. I don't know. But is it conspiracy? Is it real? I don't know. But everything sounds weird when you think about that. If you go back to 2017, there was a guy announced, the former prime minister of Sarkozy, Fillon, who was supposed to be president. But there was no competition. The guy, I mean, he got stopped because he got three suits or four suits for free from a friend of him, and because his wife was paid by the parliament for doing nothing. I mean, it's not that it's good to be paid without doing nothing, but actually that's minor if you consider what's going on today. And the French, they didn't vote for him. He was out at the first round.
Yeah.
He was supposed to be the president, but think about that. The guy was close-tied with the Russian.
That's why they got rid of him.
In 2014, there was already messing around in Ukraine. The war actually started
in
2014.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they couldn't afford to get a Fillon. It would have looked to find a way to, you know, to be more compromising with Putin. Now, instead of that, they put like a pure product. So I wonder sometimes if the guys, I mean, Macron hasn't been like brainwashed like by MK Ultra stuff. I mean, you know.
Well, he's a former Rothschild banker, isn't he? You know, he's, I mean, that's my limited take on French politics and specifically Macron is like, I find him an interesting character because, you know, even though he is a very effeminate and he comes across as a weak guy, he's a survivor. He's outlived Merkel, Angela Merkel. He's outlived four British prime ministers, you know, and he's still in position. And when you said there was something fishy about the election, well, yeah, I absolutely think that we're at a point now in history where the power structure above national governments have figured out how to rig elections. And they figured it out to such a point where they don't care whether we know or not. What are you going to do?
Like,
it was so blatant what they did in America in 2020. It was so blatant. The whole world knew. But they were like, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, fuck you, you know? So, but what's interesting for me about French politics is how they use Le Pen or the Le Pen family.
Yeah.
Right? They are used as like a stalking horse to, you know, a part of the French psyche is this, what happened in the Second World War, right?
Yeah.
And they don't want that psychology to re-enter French consciousness, right?
Yeah.
So in order to ensure that their man is elected, they wheel out the Nazi, they wheel out the right-wing fascists, you know, which is, in this case, is the Le Pen family. You know, it's not just Marianne, it's the father, isn't it, as well? It goes back a long way.
Yeah.
So if they want to make sure their man is elected, even though he is completely unpopular, they wheel out the bogeyman in order to motivate the enough of the French electorate to re-elect Macron. Because how would he be re-elected? Considering what he's done to the French people, you know, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, but once again, I mean, only 50% of the people go to vote.
Mm.
You know,
and they like it like that.
And they like it like that. So nobody talked too much about the fact that, I mean, you don't take your responsibility. You don't have the right to criticize. I mean, you didn't go to vote, but you vote for who?
Mm.
I mean, who? Mm. Well, you got to vote. I mean, at least go to put a white thing. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, we don't go to vote for what? We don't need to go there. I mean, we don't vote because there is nobody, you know.
But they want it like that. I think they understand that the voting electorate, the part of the electorate that vote, can be manipulated to vote the way they want them to vote, either through propaganda or fear or whatever it is. So all those ones that don't vote, they're happy with that because they know that those people wouldn't vote for their, you know, their selections. It's like what happened in America, isn't it, with Trump?
Yeah.
That he wasn't planned to be elected. And he was able to motivate an entire section of the American public who probably haven't voted in their lives or didn't regularly vote to get out to the ballot and vote in someone who appeared to have their interests to heart rather than this financial elite that are above them. So they don't want us voting. They're quite happy with a low turnout.
Yeah. But they were very surprised, Dems, because they were not expecting having Trump being elected at the end of the day.
Yeah.
It was like a sort of, they were like you said, they were like, okay, I mean, we're going to leave this guy making a big show. I mean, you got a part of the Americans, the rural one, the one living in the condo, one from Texas. I mean, the stupid one, actually, not the smart one from Boston, from New York, from Washington, D.C., from, you know, the stupid one. We're going to let them play with Trump at the end of the day. I mean, Hillary will be president.
Yeah.
But they got it wrong.
So wrong. It's kind of interesting in the sense that you think they have it all sewn up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You think they have all of the bases covered, all of the doors closed, all of their guards being protecting it, but yet this reality TV star was able to dump Hillary Clinton, who was, you know, her whole life.
Yeah.
Her whole life was about that moment in time, wasn't it? It was Madam President was meant to be, you know, taking her position. It was meant to be her turn, but yet the, you know, the reality TV star was the guy who got elected.
Yeah,
I think it's really interesting to watch that unfold because it did give me some hope that it's not completely sewn up. And even though Trump was, you know, relatively disappointing in his term, he did get some interesting stuff done. But for me, it's, you know, he's having another go, isn't he? Trump 2024 is going to be an interesting campaign. It might be more, you know, more funnies for us to laugh at the other side, you know. it kind of, for me, how I judge it is how their media, their propaganda attacks, you know, a certain figure, and they really hate him. They really hate him.
Yeah.
And
but they loved him before.
They loved him before until he called them out.
Yeah.
You know? So what's your take on that, on this idea with Trump 2024? Are you going to get the popcorn in and watch the show?
Well, I mean, I'm not a specialist, but in the United States, you know, it works. I mean, you got two-party vote.
Mm.
Trump seems to be the one surrounded. And I think that he will be better surrounded than he was the first time. And he will be better prepared in order to fight against what he didn't expect to come when he did his first term. Yes, of course. I mean, I don't see any other option than having Trump. I mean, I was having this conversation, even just for the memes.
You know, that's what I mean.
I was having this conversation. I mean, Trump is an interesting and probably very he has a very strong instinct. He's an animal, you know, and he's a winner. He's a fighter.
He's uncultured as well, largely for, you know, their tastes. And I think that's what they don't like about him. He puts ketchup on his steak.
But the guy, I mean, if you listen up an interview, I tried to listen up the interview with Tucker Carlson, Trump and Tucker Carlson. It's kind of boring.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not interesting because intellectually speaking or culturally speaking, Trump doesn't bring anything. Maybe if you see the guy and you have a steak with him, I mean, it would be probably very interesting to have such an animal in front of you with lots of stories. And he probably is very instinctive. He maybe doesn't need to develop his idea because he's so strong, so smart. But I'd listen up the guy. I mean, it's almost boring, you know, like Elon Musk. I mean, Elon Musk is a beast too.
Mm.
But when you listen up an interview from Elon Musk, I mean, you got to be attached because it's boring, you know. Listen up the guy, it's boring. When you listen a guy like Putin, you have a little bit of history.
Well, he's clearly an intellectual as well as a political, you know, beast and a military leader. Yeah,
you really learn something about Russian. I mean, I'm not saying that you got to take everything, digest it 100%, say, okay, well, we are just behind Putin. But I'm saying that at least if you take a seat and you listen properly, you got someone who is explaining
stuff. Did you watch the Tucker Carlson interview?
Totally. It was very interesting. I mean, just culturally speaking, it was very interesting.
But politically as well, it was like I felt like we were getting a little look behind the curtain of U.S.-Russian foreign policy over the last 30 years, or even more. He took us back to 800 A.D., didn't he? You know, we went all the way. And it was fun to watch the history lesson that he gave Carlson and everyone else watching.
Yeah.
He was getting a little bit impatient with Putin taking his time, half an hour he took to give us a lesson in Russian history, and it was a fascinating insight. But you're right, because you wouldn't get that from Trump.
No.
You wouldn't get that from Musk. I mean, I don't know who you would get that from from any Western leader.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I was watching it thinking, you know, we are so bereft of any talent from our leaders.
Yeah.
Our leaders are so incompetent or so corrupt that there's very little for us to get behind them. But Putin came onto that stage and, you know, he demonstrated his ruthlessness, his intellectual capacity, you know, his ability to hold an audience. I thought it was a very, very impressive display.
That was interesting. And I thought that even Tucker Carlson was a little bit light sometimes, you know. He didn't have the, maybe he was not prepared.
Or he was in awe, you know.
he was told to act in a certain way. I don't know. Maybe it's not easy. It's probably not easy to interview such a man. But yes, I mean, they did a great job too, because you get to adjust, I guess, to this sort of character. But yes, it was very interesting, very, very interesting. We learned something, but it was very smart too. I mean, when he said that the Americans, they are the king of propaganda, I mean, they know exactly what they're doing. I mean, they own everything. I mean, he could have been worse, but he didn't. He was pretty cool.
He was very cool. But that was a really good point, that because it was like, because a few people have said to me in the past, they said, okay, well, look, if Putin's, on the ball, if he's pushing back against America, why doesn't he reveal that 9/11 was an inside job? Surely the Russians must know. They must have the evidence in the same way that other nations do. But he gave an insight into why they wouldn't do that, because they don't have the organs of propaganda that the American empire and, you know, the rest of the West do, with all of the control of the media. Yeah. So even if he did say it, no one would hear him say it, would they? You know, and that's why the Tucker Carlson interview was so important, is that he was able to have an audience of last time I looked, it was 170 million people had watched it on Twitter.
Yeah.
That's probably the biggest audience he's ever had.
But the Russian, they are... Yeah, they're a chess player.
Yeah.
They see things and they're more profound than, I'm sorry to say, but the Anglo-Saxon world.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Well, I'm talking about the Anglo-Saxon world, because the French now, they are just vassal of the Americans, actually. We're not free anymore. So what we used to bring on the theater, on the international scene, maybe 50, maybe at the time of De Gaulle, and maybe way before, I mean, we don't bring it anymore because the Americans are behind. And so today, I mean, you got the Anglo-Saxon world who wants to dominate, but they don't have the depth, and they come up with crazy idea. I mean, really, I mean, it's just fucked up what they're coming up with their woke culture. And on the other side, you have the people carry with them. I mean, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy. I mean,
serious culture.
Gogol. I mean, they bring something. I mean, they bring something serious. I mean,
but it's a contrast,
isn't it?
It's
not Donald, and it's not Walt Disney. You know, I mean, it's something serious and deep that they bring on the table.
But that was interesting. What he said. He said the two presidents that he had a personal relationship with. Yeah. Yeah. That he respected. One was George W. Bush, I was surprised about. Yeah. And the other, he said, Trump. You know, he had a good personal relationship with Trump. But they bring a contrast to the current situation we have in the West with the woke culture and the collapse of masculinity, the collapse of all of these ideas that we built Western culture on. And the Russians are saying, you know, that's not happening here, you know.
Yeah. That's interesting about the woke culture and the lack of masculinity, because you were coming with this idea of the French being like, you know, where we go into revolution and we are very tough. But I mean, when you ask, I don't know exactly the numbers, but when you ask the French, do you want to go out of the European community? And a bunch of them, they're going to say, no, we don't want, because we're too small. It's not exactly the proof of strong people to say we're too small. If we were courageous, if we were brave, we would say, fuck off, of course. We don't want to stay in the European community. Even if it goes through trouble, we don't want to stay here. No, I mean, people, they're like, no, we're going to be too small compared to China. You know, we want to stay with no balls anymore, you know. We killed the real men. I mean, I think that we killed the real men in Europe after World War One. We killed all the real men. We just sent them to butcher.
That's right.
And then after what we got. I mean, we got the German who were like very pissed because they were humiliated at the end of the Versailles Treaty. And then, I mean, there was this Pacific wave coming toward England and France. And we're like, well, peace and love. We don't want to go to war. And then we got beaten up badly by the German. Yeah. And then the American and the Russian, they carpet bombed and they destroyed Germany. And then we got like German. They are like the French and they're like the English. I mean, they don't want to fight. I mean, everything is peace and love. I mean, you know, I mean, let me pick my sex because, you know, I don't feel good as a man. I mean, now I'm a woman. I mean, this is ridiculous. And at the same time, you have the leaders saying, well, we're going to have to prepare to go to war against the Russian. I mean, who wants actually to freeze his ass somewhere in Ukraine to fight against the Russian?
And haven't they learned their lesson? Yeah, you know, you go and fight the Russians on their turf. You ain't coming back, you know.
Yeah. Seriously, I mean, do you have any man who really wants to fight against the Russian? I mean, seriously, those guys, they got the spirit. They are patriot. They like their country. I mean, who likes his country today?
But, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons for the migration into Europe, which is, you know, clearly destroying us. But, you know, is that, are they going to be press ganged into being cannon fodder for this? You know, is this showdown with Russia what we're seeing now? Is this going to, you know, continue? Because it's clear that the Russians are absolutely squashing the Ukrainian the military. Where's that going to go? They're going to keep plowing more money, more people, more bodies, or are they going to start sending men in from the West? You know, I don't know where that's going
to
go.
But I think they're bluffing. I mean, they're just like trying to scare out people out of a World War III that will never happen. I mean, not now, because we don't have any money. When you think about, when you go back in 38, 39, I mean, at least the Americans, they had money.
Yeah.
The Russian, they maybe not had the money, but the Americans, they had the money to go into war. Today, who got the money? I mean, they're all in debt, like tremendously in debt. So maybe they need to scare people out to take their money from their bank. Yeah. You know, we need to take your money, guys. You need to contribute to the war in Ukraine. Otherwise, we're going to send your kids.
That's how they, in the UK, that's how they implemented income tax.
Yeah.
Income tax was to pay for the war. And it was only meant to be temporary. It was only meant to be, we're just going to pay these debts, guys. Yeah. Don't worry. Yeah. And it was an emergency law that they brought in for income tax, right? Yeah. Yeah. And once the war was over, you know, that should have went with it, but it didn't. It's still in place.
Yeah.
And it's still an emergency law. They have to bring it in every year at the beginning of every session.
Oh, okay.
Right? They restate this emergency income tax law so that they can keep stealing our labor.
Yeah, they need to keep people like... Mm. It's going to happen to me. Oh, oof. Mm. It didn't happen. Mm. It's right. Okay. Okay. I paid the tax. Mm.
But back to the point about staying in the European Union. I mean, on its face, right, it's a good idea. Right, on its face, about the European people to end the mass slaughter of our people that we've seen over the last 100, 200 years. Scores and scores of millions of our people have died in pointless wars for bankers, right? Yeah. And on its face of it, it sounds like a good idea. Look, you know, let's bring an end to this slaughter, this death, and we can work together. We can, you know, be partners and we can still maintain our sovereignty, but we work together as a partnership. But that's not what it is it? The EU is a like a communist structure in a sense,
yeah,
and
it's
about, you know, destroying the European identity, not harmonizing, not increasing it, not strengthening it.
Can we talk about a European identity? I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I mean, I feel European, but I feel French, and I'm very happy to meet and to talk with an English who feels English before anything else, because there is a difference between you and I, and those differences, they helps us to evolve,
mm-hmm.
because there is probably things that from your country, from your perspective as an Englishman, that's very interesting for me to think about it, and vice versa. If we're all the same, in the same pocket, thinking exactly the same, I mean, maybe not now because we belong already, you and I.
But I think that's what they're trying to do, though, isn't it, with the EU, is to level that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, is the communist idea of we don't want you to have any, you know, cultural, ethnic identity. We want to get rid of all of that.
But that's dramatic because there is no progress in terms of technology, in terms of science. I mean, there is no competition anymore. Before, we could say at this point, I mean, the English, they were dominating the ocean. I mean, at this point, the French, they were dominating this, and the German, this and this and that. There was like a real, the Italian, I'm not going to forget the Italian.
Well, it's easy to forget the Italians when it comes to war, isn't it?
But there was like something going on, you know? I mean, today they wanted to put us in the same box and that's it. We shut up and that's it. And in the meantime, I mean, you got like, I mean, the we're getting so behind compared to the Chinese, compared to the Russian, and maybe compared to the Africans tomorrow.
It's crazy.
I mean, it's like 200 years late. I mean, if you project yourself in the next 100 year, I mean we are on the wrong track for our kids. I mean, it's not good at all.
No,
it's not good at all, because when the state is not anymore able to invest in their structure in order to maintain a country, and when a state is not able to pay properly their teachers, to maintain their hospital and to maintain their roads and to maintain an army credible enough to say, okay, that's our place, guys. Don't come to bother us.
Mm-hmm.
When a state is not able to do that anymore, it's the end.
It's the end. But that's what we're seeing right now, isn't it? Is the total capitulation and treachery of our leaders. They're betraying their own people on a scale that is unimaginable.
Yeah.
You know, is that?
Yeah.
And I can't quite get my head around it, because even the elite, right? Even the landowning elite, you know, they're going to lose out as well, because ultimately, even the peasants, their role is still to act as a barrier, you know, to protect the landowners from their, you know, look what happened in Russia with the revolution in Russia. Is that, you know, they were sold the idea that it was going to be, you know, a people's revolution to, you know, to overthrow the royal landowning class. And in reality, it was just a mass slaughter to put in another ruling class that didn't have any Russian interests at heart at all, you know.
Yeah.
So I find it a little bit confusing, in that it's because even in Portugal, right here now, is the Portuguese government have you know, being kind of proactive in trying to bring in foreign investment, because it's a poor country and they were trying to bring in some money, right?
Yeah.
And they seem to have done that.
Yeah.
They brought in foreign investment you know, there's you know, wealth coming in, but the Portuguese people aren't seeing any of it.
No.
Right? It's like the property prices are increasing, but it's like it's got to trickle down, hasn't it? If there's going to be money in, it's got to trickle down to the native people. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, there's just going to be an uprising.
Like I mean, it's always like that. Mm. I mean, but coming back to how much we've been betrayed by our elite. I mean, think about a guy who is part of those guys. I mean, who is maybe between 50 and 70. He probably studied, or part of his study was in California in a beautiful setting, mm-hmm. somewhere in Big Sur or Los Angeles or Malibu. He probably had an affair when he was a young French studying, I don't know, economic or whatever, somewhere in California. See, if he was smart and coming from the right background, he was probably taken care, groomed, mm-hmm. and sent back to France and said, don't forget, now you work for us.
Yeah.
I mean, he was probably in a different way, the same that we did when we came to United States, seduced by the level or the feeling of freedom that we had or still have in some way in United States that we don't have anymore. So they came back here. You make a career. Don't forget, you work for the state. You know, and now, I mean, those guys, they're like, okay, I gotta give it to you back. And I'm not even going into the pedophilia and the sex tape and all that. I mean, just a normal
guy,
a normal guy, not talking about crazy guys. I mean, and that's easy to see. I mean, those guys, and they're coming back to France or to Italy or to anywhere in Europe and being proud of having spent 2, 3, 5, 10 years working for a company or studying in some prestigious university in America and coming back to their country, say, well, I mean, you've been in the United States. Yeah, I've been in the United States. You studied there. Yeah, I mean, now we're going to change the world. We're going to make a beautiful place. Mm. But in fact, they're working for an agenda. They don't even realize at the beginning when they do that. I mean, some of them, I believe, you know, so that the level of treason is so deep and so, you know, subtle. So it's very smartly done, you know.
So there's always a kind of a question, is that, is it by design, right? Or is it by accident? You know, is it a part of a sequence of events that is irreversible? It's like, you know, we're at the point of total incompetence of our leaders. They don't have the skill, the ability, or the talent in order to be able to have a visionary idea of where France or England is going to be in 50 years or 100 years time. You know, or is there a group of, you know, people who are hell-bent on the destruction of Western Europe? You know, it's difficult to grasp. You
know? I see what you mean. Now, well, I mean,
because France itself, you know, if we talk about revolutions, and you know, we're talking about revolutions in Ukraine, right, which we now call a color revolution, don't we? And we see these other color revolutions around the world that we've witnessed over the last 50 years, that the American government, the CIA, they're all involved in, you know, using the same playbook in order to overthrow uncooperative governments. And then they install their government. Well, one of the mothers of all color revolutions, in my view, is the French Revolution. It's like what we've seen since the French Revolution is... you know, it was like the birth of communism. It was the birth of this whole like left progressive woke ideology. It can all be rooted back to the French Revolution.
But they don't remember that.
No, but it's ingrained within the psyche at some level. The academics do, and the intellectuals may do, and the political strategists may do. Yeah. You know, but what's your take as a Frenchman on the French Revolution?
Well, I had one day this argument with my dad that I don't see anymore, who is a Freemason. And I was disagreeable to him because I said, look, I mean, this is just a bourgeois revolution. Mm. This is not a real revolution. I mean, consider that 90% of the population lived in the countryside and they were living well. You know, everything was fine. And the country was pretty well organized. And there was not like a centralized authoritarian system coming from Paris and just like rippling over the country. There was like different poles of power in the whole country in terms of administrative organization. I mean, the country was well. We had inventors, we had thinkers, we had the best land in the world in order to cultivate, to get good food. We had the best army in the world. We were the first country in the world, actually, mm-hmm. before the French Revolution. The French Revolution was a Freemason revolution. Mm-hmm. It was a communist thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think it was an attempt to take the knees away, the power away from France?
You got the power, you got the power.
Because the church, it was the connection with the church was severed too, wasn't it? You know, and it's like it became a secular state, whereas before it was quite a religious Catholic state. Yeah. And it was a total transformation in the French, you know, psyche and this ideology.
Yeah, I remember about, what's the name again, about this Freemason who was living at the beginning of the United States. He was very famous.
Franklin?
No, a guy who never occupied, I think, any...
Oh, I know what you mean. Yeah. It'll come to me in a minute. It's General Pike.
You know, he said everything.
Yeah.
He said everything. So.
But in France, how did the French perceive the revolution as a positive development in French history?
They believe. I mean, we've been educated to believe that the French Revolution was a good thing for us.
Yeah.
That it brings...
Because it's quite controversial to say otherwise, isn't it?
Well, but we don't talk anymore.
Yeah.
We don't really argue anymore in France. We don't have anymore this sort of conversation that we had like 20, 30 years ago about anything. You know, nowadays we don't talk anymore. We just consume. So it's very rare, actually, to have a conversation, an open conversation with anyone. I believe it's the same in England.
It really is.
You know, it's the same everywhere. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was a young man, I mean, we had like dispute. We argued. We were even pissed with each other for a few days, few weeks before we got friend again because you were defending your point and I was not. You know, today there is no more conversation. I mean, there was, everybody has his own opinion. You don't have any opinion. I mean, you repeat stupidly what they say at the TV.
I think as well we've been conditioned by the media. What they'll do is if you speak out of line, right, if you speak against the party line, right, they will make an example of you. They will either silence you, they will take away your assets, they will, you know, ridicule you, criticize you in public. So people go, I don't really want that to happen to me. Unless, you know, it's something you believe quite strongly about and you're not going to be intimidated by those things. Generally, most people will go, I'll
human being is a gregarious animal, you know. They want to stay in group, you know. They want to be part of the band. I mean, in one band at least. I mean, whatever it is, I mean, they want to be part of the group. So, I mean, look, I mean, if you talk about what's going on in Gaza, I mean, you're an anti-Semite. But people forgot what's the meaning of being an anti-Semite. I mean, 90% of the Jews, they are not even Semite.
No.
So what's that mean, being an anti-Semite? So, I mean...
But it just shows the power they have over control of words, you know, that people can quiver just at being called a name. You know, they can literally go into like a physical...
There is a law in France that doesn't allow you to have this type of conversation now about the Jew, about Gaza, about Israel.
Yeah.
And if someone is listening to you in a restaurant and sitting in that you're having this conversation, you could be... You could get into, I mean, how do you call that? It's a dictature.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
It's a dictature.
Yeah.
We're not talking about, I mean, no, it's a dictature. I mean,
but it says something, doesn't it, that they are so afraid of your words, that the words can have that much power, right? And the truth can have that much power that they need to impose this extremely strict authoritarian tyranny just to keep your mouth shut.
So it's, and they've been working like that for years. I mean, it's not new, actually. I mean, the COVID as a positive aspect is that the people like us, that we got more into the subject because there was this hoax coming up. So we dig up a little bit more about what's going on in the world. And the people who had intuitively kind of, they'd help them to open up their mind. But the brainwashing work, I mean, is lasting for since the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Since the French Revolution, well, before it was maybe not heaven. I mean, probably the church was also kind of brainwashing people. 100%. But there was like a structure. There was a family structure. There was something that worked with nature, with natural law. Today, nothing works with natural law. They're trying to dystopian.
Well, they're trying to move us further and further and further away from any connection to nature, which is why the bread.
That's the bread.
This is an act of rebellion.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, it's an act of rebellion as we try to move back to nature and to the real, authentic things that, you know, we can understand
and
there, the world.
Again, I mean, it's getting like, you know, I mean, some people, they ask me, how would you improve your bread? I mean, there is nothing really that I can improve. I mean, it's always the same thing. I mean, it's maybe better one day than the others, but I mean, it's always the same thing. The only way I can improve my bread is to get the best seed. So now it's getting difficult to get the best seeds. When I'm talking about seed, I'm talking about genetically modified seed.
Yeah.
It's very rare. Wow. It's almost impossible to find in Portugal. I don't know if it is possible to find in Spain. I know it is possible to find in France, but I know it's difficult to get the link in order to get these seeds back to south of Portugal So that's my next step, is to organize myself in order to get the right people back in France in order to get the right unmodified seed.
It's quite terrifying, really, isn't it? Because it's such an irreversible thing, you know, is that we get to a point where there isn't any seed that isn't genetically modified. I mean, that's like a pretty terrifying prospect of a future, you know, a dystopian future if there ever was one, that you can't get anything that, because, you know, I've had this conversation before with someone, I can't remember who it was right now, but it's about the main idea behind genetically modifying seed is not to improve the seed, it's to control it, because they can patent it. Mm-hmm. When it's natural, they can't put a patent on it, but the moment they alter the genetic structure, they can put a patent on it. And when it's a patent on it, you know, there's a copyright, you can't use it without my permission, right? Or you need a license from me in order to use the seed. It's total control of the food supply.
Well, look at the job they did in Mexico. Mexico is a place where you find so much diversity in terms of corn. The black one, the red one, the yellow one, the small one, the big one. I mean, the corn that we know, that our kids know, this is the big yellow one that you buy at the supermarket. And that's the same for the wheat. I mean, the wheat that I buy is organic, but who knows, maybe it comes from Ukraine. Who knows? I mean,
That is the breadbasket of Europe, isn't it? Ukraine, that's what people have fought over Ukraine for so many hundreds of years, is that the soil is so fertile. You know, you've only got to throw a seed there and the next thing you know, you've got a field full of wheat.
I remember this movie. It was, have you seen Stalingrad? The Battle of Stalingrad.
I know the battle.
You're going to watch this movie.
Okay.
The Battle of Stalingrad. You're going to find it. It's a German movie.
Yeah.
You see those soldiers who come, German soldiers, they come back from Africa. They're standing in Italy. Beautiful weather, beautiful everything. I mean, they're waiting before they're going to be sent in Russia, in Stalingrad, for the ultimate battle. And going to Stalingrad, they cross Ukraine. And Ukraine, part of Ukraine is like flat land, just with wheat everywhere. And you got these beautiful soldiers like Tan coming back from Italy. They go to fight the Russian. They don't know what's going to happen for them there. They think that they still think that they are the best in the world. They go there and they look at the farmers and the woman, I mean, cutting the weeds, and like this kind of bucolic picture of Ukraine, you know, the grenier of Europe. And then they got there in Stalingrad, and we know what happened in Stalingrad, you know. I mean, they cross Ukraine, the blade, the wheat everywhere, you know. That's a very interesting movie to see, to put back in perspective with what's going on today.
I've been to Kiev. I remember the Liverpool Football Club played Champions League final in Kiev, and, you know, I was fortunate enough to go. We got beat by Real Madrid, but it was I didn't know what to expect of that city, but it was really steeped deep in cultural history. You can feel it. This is an ancient place. You know, this is older than Moscow, isn't it? You know, Kiev.
I think
Kiev was once the center of Russia. You know, it's a extremely important place in
well, that's why they wanted to kill the church too there.
Yeah,
to cut people from their common background with Russia, actually. Yeah.
The women were amazing as well. Like, yeah, I give them a 10. Yeah. I think we're going to wind it up in a sec. Have you got anything else
he didn't taste the bread.
Well, that's what I was going to. That's what I was going to finish on. My belly was rumbling. I was thinking, enough of this shit about politics. Let's eat the bread. I didn't want to have a mouthful of bread and then talk about revolutions in France. But, so is there anything else that you wanted to chat about?
Fine.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed chatting to you,
that
Jean.
Was cool.
Thank
you.
We could do it again, right? Because I always want an opportunity to get some free bread from you, because I know how much it cost me. talk me through it. You want to serve me up?
Yeah, do you want to, what do you want to do? Like, no, go ahead, serve it. Just take a piece
of. Do you have the butter on it? Or do you
I wouldn't put any butter on
it.
No, okay. No, I wouldn't put
it. Is that a crime? Is it? Yeah. What are you doing putting butter on my bread?
No, not with the saucisson, no.
So tell me about the saucisson. Once you've eaten your bread.
I don't know too much about where it comes from. I know that it comes. I go. I told you.
That's like a meal in and of itself.
I go amazing. Once a month in Loulé to see the French butcher.
Show the camera. Amazing. Really amazing.
There is a French butcher there.
Where is this, in Lule?
Mm-hmm. At the market. The meat is wonderful. He knows how to cut the meat. He knows how to pick the meat. The meat is from Portugal. And anything like that comes from France.
Mm.
Wonderful.
The beef here, like La Roche beef, you know, they eat a lot of beef, but the beef here isn't great. They don't. They make amazing black pork. I love the black pork, but I think the beef here is a little bit tough, you know?
Yeah, well, you compare to UK, for instance.
Yeah.
I know that in UK, I spent like a few months.
I think there's one thing the English know how to do is raise beef.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a really... I remember that I lived in Devon for 3 months, and we eat wonderful meat.
Mm.
I was surprised because it was a few years after the famous vache folle. Remember the vache folle? It was like a big thing in France. Like they had to kill, I don't remember how many cows in UK because they were infected by...
Foot in mouth. Yeah.
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 So we were there and I didn't know anything about meat in UK. And we met a couple of butchers. They are not fancy butchers like you see in France, but they're very much into their products. Mm. And we ate like wonderful meat, you know. Yeah. I even prefer the way they cut it, like thick and nice, compared to France.
Yeah.
Lots of... But the meat is not too bad here. If you go to Batista, for instance, they had a selection of beef that they...
The aged stuff? Yeah, yeah, it's quite expensive, though. It's like, that's the price, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's like... So we go to Apollonia, and I get some Argentinian beef. Amazing. Really, really, really good.
Don't buy Argentinian meat.
Don't buy Argentinian meat. Why, what's the problem with Argentinian meat?
Because you get to defend your country. You get to defend your zone.
I don't mind the Argentinians. I like the beef. Right?
I know. I mean,
but they have American beef. They have Argentinian beef. They don't have any British beef, though, you know?
Yeah, but they got French. They got Portuguese. The Portuguese beef is good. Mm. I mean, I won't buy anything, but I've been in South America. I mean, the beef is wonderful. Yeah, no problem. But when I see a piece of Angus, for instance, usually from Texas, I'm like, oh, no, I'm not going to buy that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy that. I mean, the treaty are killing the farmers. The European farmers are killed by the European treaties they pass with farmers from around the world. I mean, a farmer in Texas...
I've committed an absolute crime here. Yes. I'm like, by buying the Argentinian beef.
Of course. Of course. I mean, the farmers in Chile, I mean...
Fucking good beef, though.
Chile. Yeah, I believe you. Even the wine is great.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, when you got like... you are defending the interest. You are playing with the treaty, the people of Brussels when you buy the meat from somewhere else. I mean, if I was going to Devon, to UK, and I go to buy a piece of meat from Texas, I mean, it doesn't make sense. I'm going to buy the meat from you guys.
Yeah, because we produce amazing beef.
Yeah.
Right, that's the reason I eat a lot of beef, right? But what about the black pork? I love the...
Yeah, see, good. Very good.
Better than English pork.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know about that, but very good.
Yeah, yeah,
very
it's good. Better than English pork. It's like, wow, this tastes really, really
very good.
Yeah. Mm. What about English cheese? I know this is a sore point, isn't it? What you call that, cheese?
No, I mean, I respect anyone who works with his hand and makes good products. I mean, there is like a good cheese in England. So the diversity is not there, but look at the country. I mean, it's not the same diversity in terms of climate, in terms of space. Than if you talk about Italy or France, I'm referring always to the two countries because they're very similar in the way that they produce their food and the way they attach to their food.
But I think they're the two most creative countries in Europe.
I think terms of food, definitely.
Not just food as well. It's like many aspects of their culture.
But they are quite similar. I mean, Italian are maybe more smiling than French, but they are quite similar people.
Yeah.
They don't like each other.
Quite a rivalry. I think there's a lot of respect, though, as well, you know? They may not like each other, but there's definitely like a competitive respect amongst each other.
That competition is very good for us.
Yeah, yeah.
We need to compete with each other.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why, I mean... you know, I love English football.
Okay.
Or English rugby.
Do you have a team?
No, I don't have any team. Yeah. I mean, I used to have a team when Cantona played.
United.
But I like it because you see those guys, they go into fight.
Yeah.
They're brave. And the English, they are like that. They're brave. They like to go into fights.
But Cantona, right, was a really interesting character in that he went into the English arena and even outshone the English fighting football men, you know?
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that moment where he did the flying kick. I loved it. I remember watching it. Match of the Day came on, and Des Lynam was the commentator, and he went, "It was a terrible day in English football today." it was like someone had died, right? And I was like, "What happened? What happened?" And then you see Eric Cantona doing this flying karate kick. I loved him. I mean, because I'm a Liverpool fan,
yeah.
So we have major rivalry with Manchester United, but he is one of the few Manchester United players that I used to love him. I thought he was really
Cantona is great. Yeah. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest French, I mean, in terms of athlete. I mean, he says what he thinks. Mm. And that's why he had to leave France.
Yeah.
He says, you know, that's a prime with France.
Yeah.
That's a prime. If you got a big mouth and you got talented in the same time and you got a big character, you got to run away and to go somewhere else because they won't always try to shut you down.
Is he back in France? I mean, what's his...
I don't know. I think he lives in between Portugal and France.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
He's an actor.
Yeah.
His wife is a filmmaker.
Yeah, he's cool. He's really cool guy.
But he's a cool dude. I mean, definitely. Mm. I mean, I respect a lot this guy. I mean, he's strong. But coming back to sports, I mean, well, that's what I like about the English. They're brave. They go into fight.
Yeah.
And when you look at their football, I mean, you see people playing on the field, you know.
Yeah. The problem the English have at the moment is that they're putting their fighting spirit into sport rather than defending their own country. Right, and it's
weird. But they do that everywhere.
I know, but they've manipulated the spirit into like this pointless sport, right?
Absolutely.
they'll hit the streets if there is a little tweak in the rules of the game, right?
Yeah,
but you know,
when
it comes to, you know, what happened in COVID, they were all hiding in their houses.
Well, like so the Italian, they feel Italian only when they play football.
Yeah.
Other than that, they don't feel Italian. They're like hiding. No, we want the European community.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we protect it.
Mm. Anyway, Jean, we can keep going on and on,
right,
and we will do it again. Now I'm going to enjoy more of this bread.
Okay,
it was an absolute pleasure chatting to you, brother.
Thank you,
right,
man.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on.
All right.
Cool.